Hello and welcome to episode 5 of Been There, Done That, a podcast series for independent coffee shop owners brought to you by iZettle. I'm your host, Nassos Papadopoulos, and on the show with me today is Lisa Lawson, the founder of Deer Green Coffee Roasters and the Glasgow Coffee Festival. Now, the way consumers choose to spend their money is changing fast, with more and more people looking to buy products and services that fit their values. Last year, in 2018, £83 billion was spent on ethical goods in the UK alone. But the value of running an ethical business isn't just the added sales it brings. It's also increasingly important for a lot of other things, including the hiring and retention of staff. Lisa's passion and commitment to her values have been central to the success of Deer Green, so she's the perfect person to help you do the same without risking the success of your business. More on that in a minute. But first, remember you can access today's special bonus content by going to the podcast section of the iZettle blog or direct from the link bit.ly/iZettlePodcast. That's bit.ly/iZettlePodcast. Just choose this episode on the list, go to the page and sign up on the form to access your bonus content. For this episode, you'll get a cheat sheet on running a sustainable and ethical business, as well as a copy of the episode transcript so you can get hold of the conversation in written form. Now, back to business. Lisa first got into coffee by getting a job packing beans at startup roastery Toby's Estate in Australia while she was backpacking around the country in the early 2000s. She then came back to Scotland in 2002, and after a few bad employment experiences, she decided to buy herself a roaster and set up her own roastery, and she's never looked back since. Deer Green is now one of the most exciting roasteries, not just in Scotland, but in the whole of the UK. And Lisa has played a huge part in growing and cultivating the specialty coffee scene in Glasgow, both through her business and the founding of the Glasgow Coffee Festival. In this episode, we discuss a whole range of topics, including how to run an ethical business that treats suppliers, customers, and employees fairly, what independent coffee shop owners need to know about classifications like fair trade and organic, and how to run a sustainable business that minimizes its impact on the environment. There's a lot more involved in running a values-driven business than paying lip service to a mission statement on a website, as you'll discover in this episode. And Lisa is a straight talker who gets right to the core of the issues without any fluff. So I'm sure you'll enjoy our chat. I certainly did. So without further ado, please enjoy this conversation with Lisa Lawson. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Hi.
It's awesome to have you. Thanks for making the trip down from Glasgow to London today. Not everyone's had to travel as far as you have, but it's great to have you here.
Oh, no problem. No, it's nice to get out of Glasgow. It's nice to see London. It's a lovely day here today.
For sure. Yeah, it is. We've got a lot to go into today. I'm really looking forward to chatting about business ethics, sustainability. But before we get into all of that good stuff, tell me a little bit about how you got into coffee.
Sure. Yeah. Well, for me, it was a complete accident. I happened to be backpacking in Australia and got a job packing beans for a guy in his mum's garage, actually. I think I got $10 an hour cash in hand. Should I say that recorded? I don't know. And that happened to be a company that I worked for then for the best part of 3 years until I got chucked out of Australia. And I stayed there for so long because I really fell in love with coffee. I found out there, you know, there were single origins, that coffee was a seed from a cherry, from a tree, all that stuff. And that, you know, that was 18 years ago. So that was a real change of direction for coffee in Australia at the time. And I was part of that wave of change to experience it firsthand. I did that back then, year 2000 until late 2002. And I came back to Scotland and there was nowhere really I could do the same thing because everywhere was buying, you know, large branded coffee from large European companies or national UK company. There weren't really a culture for freshly roasted or specialty grade or single origin. So I worked in wine for a while and then I eventually decided to buy a roaster. So I started my company, Deer Green Coffee Roasters, in 2011. And we brought something new to Glasgow and tried to create a change in the coffee culture then in Scotland, which was all ready to kick off anyway, I think, based on what was going on around the world and in London as well. So we had that influence. So yeah, Deer Green's been going for over 7 years now, and we supply wholesale and retail around the UK. So mainly a wholesale coffee roasting company. We just opened a cafe this year and we do heaps of barista training and we organise the Glasgow Coffee Festival and all that kind of stuff. And we're just kind of pretty active, I suppose, and love it. Yeah.
What was the spark that made you want to buy the first coffee roaster once you'd gone back to Glasgow?
I think I'd always wanted to, but never really had any money, so didn't really see it as a reality in my life until one day I just kind of snapped because I think a series of bad employment experiences, but one particularly bad one made me just put the deposit for a coffee roaster on a credit card, and I naively thought I could get a business loan for the rest of the value of the roaster, which is ridiculous. But I got a bunch of private loans from friends and family, which is all paid back now, phew. And that was just really a point where I think I had pretty rubbish jobs, and I always did what I loved but never got paid particularly well. And then I was in my early 30s and thought, okay, I need to change this and give this a go. So yeah, bought my first 12-kilo ProBat.
How did your early sort of employment experiences affect the way that you wanted to treat people that you were hiring for your business? And so I guess that's one sort of route into the main theme of the episode on values and ethics. But let's start off with the people, which is such a big part of business.
Yeah.
How has that influenced you in the way you sort of look at your employees and the way you interact with them?
Yeah, I think it's influenced me massively. I've always, I've had heaps of jobs. So I've had heaps of employers with very varied experiences. I've felt like part of a family, and then I've felt, like a number in a payroll. So when I started Dear Green, I don't think it was a conscious decision to treat people well or to have that part as part of the values and ethics. It was just something that was intrinsically in the way I do things. And so the first person I had working for me was just packing coffee a few hours a week. And, I was adamant that I'd be paying the real living wage rate. So it wasn't like the minimum wage or it was basically what the Glasgow living wage was at the time. And I've done that ever since. Anyone knew that is the minimum that I'll hire anyone on. But yeah, I think, I like the idea of the staff being part of a team, part of a family, like having feeling autonomous, being able to make decisions. And we make decisions as a collective about a lot of things. We respect one another, we hang out, we have ethical business practice also in terms of, just occupational health and safety, breaks, time out, all the kind of legal stuff that maybe doesn't get enforced particularly well in some businesses. So that's super important to me, and I think also because of the products we work with, the people that are the other side of that value chain that we're working with are perhaps not getting treated so well, and certainly have extremely different experience of life from us in terms of being from a developing country and, picking cherries perhaps in barefoot and then walking miles with a basket of coffee cherry on their head to get paid for the weight in the basket that day. And I just feel like I can't have ethics related to the product and then not for my own staff. So it's part of a bigger picture and a much bigger story.
Yeah, I definitely want to pull on that thread in terms of the start of the supply chain and what you're talking about. And I know you've gone out and done site visits and met farmers that you've bought from.
Yeah.
But just cycling back to the employees, you touched on the fact that a lot of people don't take care of the sort of important things like giving staff the right to have time off, creating sort of a family environment, a family atmosphere, like creating a good culture and so on and so forth. A lot of these things sound like buzzwords to a lot of people. And I know a lot of independent coffee shop owners who are listening to this, or prospective independent coffee shop owners, they'll have heard so many people talk about it. But how do you think about it on like a practical level? Like what do the practices look like? Is it just making sure that you've got your contracts all set up and the employees are aware of it and there's no sort of information that you have that they don't have? Like, talk to me about like good culture and dealing with people on a practical level.
It's funny you mentioned that, because the first staff member I had, the first full-time member of staff, was actually my best friend.
Okay.
So there wasn't really any contact. It was just like, hey, can you work for me? I'm really busy and I need help. And then you start to have to, you're in a huge learning curve when you're in a business. So then you realise, you're like, oh, I suppose I should have a contract. I suppose we need to formalise things. And, and you have to really introduce procedures and processes. And it sounds horrible at first, because it's not, it's not me. I kind of like, I'm quite spontaneous. But for me to be an ethical employer, you have to have everything formalised. We have staff handbook, we have contracts. We're very fair about like having holidays and having time off and everyone has to take a turn if it's like a weekend shift that no one really wants to do, and everyone you end up with a rota system for it, and yeah. There's a fairness, you know. I think at the start as well, you know, my staff all got paid more than I did. I'm not necessarily driven by money. I'm driven by results and achievements. So I'm not looking to make money from staff or to, you know, have a horde of people packing up coffee for me so we can like pile it high and sell it fast. It's not that culture of company. You're building a story and building a culture, and those people that are working for you are part of that. And you have to make them feel like they are part of that, and they take ownership of that. So the practical side of it is just about having things formalised, having records, but it's really good to have everything itemised.
Talk to me a little bit about the start of the supply chain. So I know you've done trips out to farmers that you have bought from. Talk to me a little bit about how you think about who you want to buy from, and maybe throw in some stories, if you can, of trips that you've made out there and what your experience has been like.
Yeah, so when I first started roasting in Scotland, I was quite frustrated by the information or lack of information about where I was getting coffee from. A few more importers came onto the market, onto the scene in the UK, and that made life a bit easier, but I still asked a lot of questions. And that's when I did my first really focused origin trip. The first one, I think, with Dear Green was to Guatemala and Mexico. And really, that was a learning experience. So that was just, you know, to see cherries on a tree, to see the coffee drying on the patios, to understand the process that coffee goes through in terms of what happens at a washing station, for example. So that was an educational trip originally, but then that prompts more questions. So I did another trip the same year, and that time was to Ethiopia, and that was an eye-opener. So I think everywhere I go, I've been on a lot of trips now. I do at least one a year, but I did two last year, and I should probably do an awful lot more. But ultimately, I have a business to run as well, so I can't be flying all over the place. And so, you know, it's like my job title, Green Bean Buyer, and, you know, about 14 other titles possibly as well. So it can be a bit tricky. But I know that from going on the trips I've been on, I'm working with importers that I trust. So it's not always about seeing the farm and the farmers. It's about being stuck in a 4x4 for 8 days with an importer and working out how that, you know, like how good that relationship is and how much you want to work with that that link in the supply chain again, and finding out as much information as you can.
When you hear about certifications, there's obviously so much being said these days about fair trade and Rainforest Alliance. Like, what's your experience in dealing with those certifications? What do they mean to you? And also for someone who's, you're a stage further up in the chain to someone who's an independent coffee shop buying from a roaster. Can the certifications be trusted? How do you make sure they're sort of coming from farms that are following the practices? What's your advice to coffee shop owners on understanding what these certifications actually mean and how they know what they're buying?
It's a loaded question. I haven't aligned myself with any certifications, with Dear Green, with any certifications. I buy coffee, which is a quality product on the cupping table that I know has complete traceability, and I'm working with trusted partners, and they know what I'm looking for in terms of the ethics I have. I think with certifications, if something happens to be fair trade, if it happens to be organic, if it happens to be Rainforest Alliance, that's great. Some certifications are better than others. Some certifications are better audited in some countries than others. So I don't necessarily trust what I have seen as well. I've always thought Rainforest Alliance is awesome. And then I visited a farm, which was an awesome farm, but then, you know, there's people still picking cherries in the dark with bare feet and a baby on their back at night. And it makes you ask some questions, like if they should have this certification or not. We actually have organic certification because we work with a couple of customers that require it. And it's quite easy for us to get based on the equipment and the processes and the record keeping we have. But we don't buy coffee because it's organic. We buy it because it's good. And oh, it happens to be organic. So that's great. But I would never ask a coffee farmer to get organic certification. I would ask them to go through a 3-year process, which is expensive, and a lot of coffee farms don't use any pesticides, insecticides anyway. And if they do, it's because they might lose their crop and then they've got actually no income for a whole community. So it's a really difficult...
Yeah, no, I can tell. It sounds it.
Really difficult area to talk about. And I think certification, in some cases, can get a coffee, a route to market that it wouldn't otherwise have had. And is incredible. It can put in processes and procedures and can educate farmers on things they didn't know anything about before because they're so rural. They've got no access to information. But it can hinder as well. Sometimes I see it maybe, you know, fair trade can be like a minimum wage. Maybe you can't get any higher. And you also, if the certification doesn't invest in quality, then you maybe don't have it. It's something that's sustainable.
So do you think it would be fair to say then, you know, I'm always hesitant to give advice, but for listeners who are listening in, don't just trust the certification because it's a certification and do the research yourself? Like, not to knock them, but do you think that's a fair comment someone?
I think if consumers, if they're making choices based on ethics and values, they should be well informed, and that's up to themselves. I think definitely buying certification does add a little bit of maybe... It makes you trust the product a little bit more. If you like, you know, flavour, you might want to trust a local roaster more than you... or a roaster that you know has good ethics more than you would a certification. It's like anything in life. You've got to make those informed choices.
Yeah, and do all the research you can to find out all the information you need.
Exactly.
Rather than just trusting what someone else said.
Yeah, exactly.
Talk to me a little bit about your experience communicating your value add to customers. So as a roastery, you're going and selling into lots of different coffee shops all over the UK. How do you, it's obviously becoming an increasingly crowded space. How do you differentiate your offering and how do you communicate? Because you're obviously a very values-driven entrepreneur. You're a very values-driven person. How do you communicate that to your customers? And is it something that you find they really, like, that resonates with them?
I don't know how I communicate it, to be honest. I guess it's all the usual interfaces, social media, you've got your website, you know, things like doing this podcast. And you invited me to talk about this because you already knew that that we're, you know, the culture of our company, that ethics play a big part in what we do. I guess right from the start, I wasn't following any template. I was, you know, the first locally to do what I did. And I did everything from, I didn't have any money. So, you know, like in terms of ethics of the company, I guess I was kind of frugal and I made choices that were, you know, we weren't wasting anything. We were recycling everything. You know, I cycled with all my deliveries in the early days and I don't know, I think maybe just through years and years of having this, you know, constant, we have this communication now through Instagram and Facebook and everything's documented of every movement of your day almost. And I guess our company's just been documented like that, but also because we were one of the first to the market in our area and in the UK actually for specialty coffee, and we've always had really high standards. I think that resonates with a certain customer.
Have you had a lot of customers approach you because they say, you know, we click on that, we click on values, like you're doing, from what we can see, you're doing things right and this makes sense. I mean, no, you've got a quality product, but that's like, that's why we want to go with you rather than a handful of other competitors.
Yeah, it's difficult because you do see what other competitors are doing and you know that they're not really communicating. They're communicating a message that maybe I see as being wrongly communicated, or they don't have all the knowledge to actually make the statements they're making. Disheartens me sometimes that in this industry, you know, I go to Origin, and I don't go to Origin as often as some other roasters, but I go as much as I can do for the size of my company. And some roasters I've never been, but they shout the same messages. But in terms of everything else that we do ethically, I guess it's just, for Dear Green, it's just the, it's a lot of my personal morals and values. It's just knowing the difference between right and wrong. And I guess your online voice communicates that, and you don't realize it sometimes. I wish I could ask, can we just do a survey now? Can we ask everyone, how do you know we're ethical? It's just what you, maybe because with the name Green in the company name, some people think the email is about that, or, you know, I've had emails after I've been to Origin, like basically telling me how shameful it is with climate change and carbon emissions, that I should go on all these flights, and you know, and then we've had our carbon audit done for the roastery, and we know that actually what affects our carbon emissions as a coffee roastery the most is really if everybody was driving to work every day.
Well,
but there's probably half of us cycle and a couple more get public transport, and that's like a sustainable way for us all to travel to work. And everything else we do in the roastery is everything's recycled and repurposed and reused. We don't waste any beans. If we do have any left over that maybe they've gone too stale or we're not happy with the roast, we give it to the Glasgow City Mission.
From what you're saying, I get the fact that there's obviously such an infinite range of things that you could possibly do.
Yeah.
And as long as you're just trying to follow the mantra of just doing the right thing,
yeah,
doing right by the people, you're never going to be able to please all of the people all, yeah, of the time. But if you do that, then in the long run, people are going to be like,
yeah,
this is someone I want to do business with.
Yeah, but I think the company's it's not like we said, we suppose we should have a sustainable business policy in place. And then we had to shake everything up. It's just the way the company has been right from the start.
Yeah.
And because it's my company, it's just been essentially about who I am, in a way. And then you have to create a policy around it. So, you know, it's not, we're not all corporate about it and having a social policy.
Of course, yeah. The whole corporate CSR initiatives,
yeah,
where you question whether,
exactly,
they're doing it because it's the right thing or whether because,
yeah,
it's good marketing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think maybe we've got subliminal marketing and it's just intrinsic in the culture of the company.
Have there ever been instances where you felt like you've had to make tough decisions in terms of a trade-off between your values and profitability or keeping the business going? And are there any sort of specific ones that come to mind?
I think I've always had my eye on the bottom line. I've never necessarily paid myself a lot. I just need enough money to live, so I'm not greedy. But I'm ambitious. So when I look at the company in terms of our accounts, I've always made sure that the company's healthy, therefore the company's sustainable, therefore my staff still have a job. And that's kind of how I've run the business from the start. So sometimes there's a pot of money there, and sometimes you make a big purchase. Sometimes you're like, oh, okay, we need to inject some energy into that part of the business because that's not propped up too well against something else. There's no specific example. I mean, we've done projects where it's just broken even and we're like, oh well, that was fun. You know, like we've just had a good time. We did the Glasgow Coffee Festival every year, which really sort of drains our resources as a very small company, and it's not profit making. It sort of breaks even, and if there's anything left, we donate to charity. So we're not approaching anything as like everything is capitalist. Some things we do for fun and we do for community and to maintain the coffee community in Scotland and beyond.
You touched on the Glasgow Coffee Festival that,
yeah,
you set up and that you run every year. I know there'll be a lot of people listening to this podcast who are not necessarily based in London, where coffee is sort of like almost in the same way that London eats up a lot of resource and energy in the whole of the UK. I think the coffee scene's also quite centralised here.
Mm.
But there are lots of offshoots now in different towns and cities all over the UK. Like, what's your experience been in terms of like engaging people in Glasgow, in Scotland, around specialty coffee? And, you know, should people be optimistic that they can open up a coffee shop that's a specialty coffee shop and that it can thrive and build a community around it? Like, what's your experience been in terms of educating people and, yeah, building community around it in Glasgow?
Yeah, well, when I started Dear Green, I wasn't really up against anyone, which was a bonus in terms of having another roaster that I had to compete against, a local roaster. But on the flip side, I had to really educate everyone on specialty coffee because no one really knew why it was different and why they should buy my coffee over, you know, one of the chains or one of the bigger sort of Italian branded coffees that they were using in their cafe. I wouldn't say it was a struggle. It was just an interesting time, but a lot of people were open to it. And from there, I guess a community grew. So a lot of cafes started to open up. There became a cafe culture. And a lot of them bought my product. And now there's you know, there's heaps of cafes in Glasgow that have using all different roasters and multi-roaster cafes. There are baristas that, you know, weren't around when Dare Green started. There are some of the top baristas and, you know, baristas who were around when I started out, who were in Glasgow, who were accomplished and really pushing for a career in coffee, now have their own cafes or they're working for bigger companies. So you can see how especially coffee has evolved in the same way as London, but you know, we're much smaller. We're like 1 million people in Glasgow and you know, 5 million in Scotland. It's pretty tiny. Yes, we're like a little satellite of what's going on everywhere else, but we've always echoed it and followed it. And with the introduction of social media, everyone can see what's going on around the world. The communication links are there. There's less barriers to access information and to understand what this coffee culture is. So for a tea drinking nation that got Starbucks, I think we've flipped it.
Mm.
And I think we've got really great coffee that people understand now. So the coffee festival, going back to your question, the coffee festival I started because I was frustrated that I'd come to London. And I went to, you know, I did a trip to Australia, to MICE, which is the Melbourne, International Coffee Expo. And I went to the World Barista Championship. I think that was in 2013. So I was like trying to seek out this culture for myself to inspire myself to bring it back to Scotland. And then I just hired a hall and decided, right, okay, let's do this. Let's hire a hall and invite everyone along and I just see what happens. And the first year was incredible. I think we had 1,000 people turned, like 300 tickets sold and 1,000 people turned up on the day. And we had no comprehension it was going to be that successful for year one. So now we're in year five. We moved to 2 days. And we, you know, we have so many new cafes opening all the time, new roasteries, and everyone wants to be a part of it, wants to be a part of this event because it brings people together. It showcases what we do in Scotland and also the wider community. So we have roasteries from all over the UK. Have got a stand at Glasgow Coffee Festival, or we've got importers from all across Europe coming to host a cupping. All sorts of layers of interesting stuff going on, which is like a tiny version of what's happening at London Coffee Festival or some of the bigger events around. But yeah, we've got a community of professionals who can promote that locally, and a community of consumers that want it, which we didn't have 5 years ago. Pretty cool.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. From what you were saying, like, I understand the motivation for you to really set that up was you wanted to not only bring people together, but you wanted to inspire yourself as well. Do you feel like being part of a community is a big part of sort of like inspiration and motivation for people, say, who are setting up coffee shops or who have coffee shops, or who are roasters or whatever, to come and be part of that and see all these people doing amazing things, all the energy? Like, do you see that as being one of the major benefits of community as well?
Well, yeah, it pushes everyone. Because if you're going to be at a festival, you're like, oh, I want to make sure I've brought my best coffee machine and I'm showcasing my best coffee and I've profiled it and I've got my best barista on my stand. Everyone's showcasing the best of what they are and what they can do. And that's pushing everyone else to be better. And it's been like that for years. So we've seen cafes come and go in Glasgow. And then there's always new guys setting up. And that's inspiring as well, because I'm like, wow, look what they're doing, you know, and it's stuff that I haven't thought about. And we have, yeah, it's just more, far more, I don't know, there's more of a discipline in the coffee industry. There's a standard, I think. There's an expectation of quality and what, you know, how your flat white should be and what cup it should be in and like how your espresso should taste. There's a lot more consumer knowledge as well, which pushes the cafes. And the festival's just another part of it. It's only on for one weekend in the year. But I am constantly inspired by what other people are doing around me. I always want to travel to find out what other people are doing as well. Even going to Origin and seeing a specialty coffee bar opening up in a major city in a developing country is inspiring, because you're like, wow, look, that's what they're doing now.
Mm.
It's wonderful. And it's I don't know how the next 10 years are going to go, because I can't imagine it's going to stop. We're kind of propelling ourselves, you know.
Seems to be going that way, for sure. Yeah. Well, look, I think we could go on and on, but let's finish up with a couple of quick questions. To kick off with, what are your daily coffee habits? How many cups of coffee do you have a day? What do you have? Tell me about your daily coffee rituals.
Every morning I'll make a filter coffee at home. I'll put it in a keep cup and I'll go to work and drink my coffee. So it's kickstart my brain before I've actually got to work. I get to work, I might have a flat white maybe before lunch. If I pop into the cafe, I'll always taste the espresso to make sure it's dialed in okay. Mm-hmm. And we do QC cuppings almost every day. So yeah, sometimes at 4 o'clock I'll be tasting 40 coffees.
Okay.
Yeah, and then I go straight to yoga. So
nice and wired.
It's not,
for yoga.
Not the best combination, but yeah.
Calms you down afterwards.
Yeah,
though,
I generally don't have a coffee for self enjoyment after 2 p.m. And if I cup, I'll always have a spittoon at hand. So yeah, daily. That's my daily coffee habit.
Okay. And do you have any heroes in the coffee industry, or any people that have really inspired you over the course of your journey?
Well, Toby, that I worked for initially in Australia, he's pretty inspiring. You know, I was his first employee and then he sold his company for 40 million. So that's my inspiration. There's loads of other players, you know, loads of guys on the scene that I find inspiring as well. I could mention so many people.
Yeah.
All the guys you have in a series of the podcasts.
Like you said, I think it's a really, really exciting time to be involved in the industry, and the growth trajectory is definitely going in one direction. So, yeah, really, really exciting times to be involved in the industry. And hopefully that's good news for you and Dear Green and leads to good things in the future.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We've got loads of plans. I don't know what they are yet. But heaps, yeah.
You'll make them happen.
Yeah, definitely.
Lisa, thanks so much for coming on the show. It was really awesome chatting to you today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Where can listeners find out more about you and Dear Green and all the awesome stuff that you're doing online?
Probably Instagram, a little bit of Twitter as well. So at Dear Green on Instagram, at Coffee Glasgow on Twitter. Dribs and Drabs on Facebook and our website as well. So yeah.
Awesome. We'll link to that in the show notes. Lisa, thanks again. It was awesome chatting.
Thank you.
If you're interested in more insights and advice, you can access all of the bonus content from today's episode, including the episode transcript, on our blog at izettle.com or direct from the link bit.ly/izettlepodcast. Just choose the episode you want, go to the page and sign up on the form to access your bonus content. And finally, if you enjoyed the episode, please subscribe to the show and leave us a rating and review. Thanks for tuning in to Been There, Done That, and catch you next time.